But we're more on the job 24 hours a day than some staff, and I don't mean to offend any staff or anything like that, but I think it's much more difficult for us to distinguish in our more broad responsibilities, you know, when we turn the clock on and when we turn it off. And so I think it's more appropriate that we take the legislators out of it, but leave the legislative employee in there, because I think they should be held basically to the same standard that the executive should in terms of abuse. And maybe their language is more...
Well, it seems as in another section, though, we're getting away from citizen legislature, as you just spoke to. I mean, we're going to now be compensated at $40,000 a year, which is a decent wage for a full year's employment, similar to what many of the staff make for working year-round. And, you know, is it fair that we then have some special exemption when we're getting compensated adequately for a 12-month job?
Senator Duncan.
Well, maybe the answer here is that we should hold our employees to the same standard the executive branch holds theirs, and maybe the language which Mr. Gagin read makes more sense than what we're trying to do here, that they should not misuse their office for personal gain or private gain or whatever that word was. Seems to me that makes more sense than trying to say to list all that kind of stuff, right?
And again, remember, though, that the Ledge Council was directed to draw up regulations to implement this section.
Well, that gives me a lot of confidence.
It could be the Ethics Commission. It's your own, at least.
It was our own who wrote this originally. I'm not Senator Porcio. No. I didn't mean it that way, but I wasn't going to go back to this, but is there a way we could work this, Mr. Gagin, or someone to say in a more broad term that they shouldn't misuse their office for private gain?
Sure, yeah, I mean, you could go with the existing language that Senator Porcio read.
Senator Porcio, is that a problem?
It's interesting that if you went with the existing language, you'd have the same problems that you talked about for the exemptions. This actually speaks more to the occasional use of things than the existing statute. The existing statute is very
vague.
I got a motion.
Go to the existing language.
Make a motion. Let's keep moving.
I moved to a delayed time. That didn't go. Have you ruled on
it? We haven't voted on that.
We haven't voted on it.
I voted to divide the question. I mean, I moved to amend.
That's not friendly amendment.
Not friendly?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'll still do it.
Okay, you can still do it.
Is there objection to moving time out? Which time?
Well, my motion was to delay time, which we should be doing.
Is there objection to that? So ordered.
There is objection to time for legislative employees.
Proposed amendment to put them back in.
Come back and propose amendment. Think we're not getting very far here. We're on page 10.
Proposed amendment. That's how you get to it.
Oh, okay. I would move that we exempt the legislator, but not the legislative employee.
Yeah.
Object.
Yep. I think it's got to be the same for both. I mean, if you're going to be consistent about it, but that.
Good question.
What? Senator Pierce.
I'm waiting for the question so I can vote.
What would we be doing? We would be just treating both as equal the same way?
No. We'll remove time. Senator Frank is proposing, I understand, the motion to put time back in for employees. And for we have a motion on the floor.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion? Okay.
Yes.
Those in favor, raise your hand. Those opposed?
Motion fails.
Motion fails. Okay. Let's keep going.
Okay. Subsection B of this, a legislator or employee may not seek or accept public funds for a purpose other than that approved through by law, or make a false statement in connection with a claim request, etc. I think that fairly tracks existing law. It's
yes, it was adopted, Mr. Chairman.
Your motion was
just
adopted.
A clarification. My motion was adopted.
Yes.
When was your motion adopted?
Just before yours.
Majors.
Oh. So I guess
there's no objection.
So time is deleted.
Just deleted.
Time
entirely.
Is entirely deleted.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. That was a consistency question.
I'm sorry.
We were by that.
I thought we were making a friendly amendment to you.
Okay. Number C, number B.
Okay.
Or an unfriendly.
B, you can't seek or accept funds for a purpose other than approved by law, and you can't make a false statement in connection with a claim application, travel reimbursement. Subject to civil sanctions and prosecution under another law, not under this section.
Any questions on this? Two questions, Senator Binkley, Senator Fisher, and then Senator Zaroff, and Senator Binkley can share for 2 minutes.
Senator Fisher.
Under this, oftentimes legislators will trust their staff. They'll sign one PR. People practice saying, well, okay, what, you know, I'll take it at the ending of session sometimes to get a car or something going, and they'll put a sign and say, okay, and move it down or fill it out. Supposing the legislature assumes to be one car, the end result is three or four. Is that under this thing?
I mean, it would for the legislative employee. I don't see anything that would tie the legislator in.
No, but the legislative employee then would be. Could be sanctioned under AS-24-6156.
If the legislator gave the employee the permission to ship one car and the employee used it to ship three, I would think so. Yeah.
Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we have just a brief explanation since this AS-24-6156A appears quite often on here. Can we just have a quick explanation of what that means?
The 560A?
Right.
That's the list of sanctions that can be imposed. It runs the gamut from things as minor as a private an agreement to not do it again or to repay whatever you took. It runs the gamut all the way up to fines of up to $5,000 and expulsion in extreme cases.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, and then what are the criminal penalties?
In this case, when it says maybe appropriate criminal penalties under another law, it depends what the other law would be. For instance, in subsection A of this one, it says maybe prosecuted for theft under 1136. That would depend on the amount of money at issue. If you're talking $500 and more, it's a Class C felony. If you're talking 50 to 500, it's a Class A misdemeanor. If you're talking less than 50, it's a Class B misdemeanor. As far as these other couple, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head which laws would be invoked.
There are some general laws dealing with falsified vouchers and that sort of thing. I think it's pretty much Class A misdemeanor stuff.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, but in a situation where, let's say, a person falsifies something and then they go to the ethics review board and they argue back and forth and the legislator aide says, okay, I won't do it anymore. The board says, okay, you're fine, go ahead and go. Just don't do it anymore. But then the Attorney General's office has to come back and charge you criminally.
No, they don't have to.
No,
they can't.
Read this here. It says, is subject, okay, to 560A in addition to. It doesn't say or. It says in addition to. So along with the civil charge, which you may resolve through the ethics committee, you also have to face a criminal charge.
It says you're subject to them. It doesn't necessarily say you have to be hit with them. If you said or, it would be either one. And the intent is, if it's a serious enough offense, you can be both expelled from the legislature and prosecuted criminally.
Okay, well, maybe I just don't feel comfortable. It doesn't sound that clear to me, and I guess, I'm...
It's like George Holman.
I'm not a lawyer.
Senator Pershing.
I'm sorry. I mean, I don't... This isn't tricky. I mean, it's not supposed to be, like, double jeopardy. It's like the Holman situation, where, you know, this guy does something, he's prosecuted criminally, and he's expelled as a matter of the discipline of the body. I mean, that's the most extreme case.
Senator Duncan. So the real question is, the definition of subject to is not mandatory. It just means that could be, you can be tried civilly and criminally, but it's not mandatory that you be tried civilly and criminally.
Right. The purpose of this is to alert people to the fact that they may also be committing a crime in St. Anna doing one of these things. And the reason that throughout this you find references to civil sanctions under a specific thing is that we wanted to be sure that only those provisions which should have a sanction had a sanction. This was the simplest way to flag each provision as a sanction. So that's there for that reason. It was easier than doing a laundry list at the end saying you can be, you know, we can nail you for violating any one of three dozen provisions. This is the way to do it. And the fact that this also could be criminal conduct, we didn't want to exclude the possibility of being prosecuted if it warranted prosecution. But cases like this where there's a number of different crimes that could be committed by somebody who violates this thing. We just didn't want to do a laundry list of possibilities. We say there may be some other thing that you're going to get punished for. In terms of timing, Senator Zuroff, the criminal prosecution had better get started about the time the Ethics Commission starts doing its job, if not before. If they wait till the Ethics Commission is through before they decide to prosecute, they may be time barred for not bringing would you think? If they were aware of it, if they're aware of the situation and don't take action? Okay. Forget it.
Ms. Adam, did you want to...
As a matter of equity, they should be prosecuting at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, I don't agree with the last comments at all. The statute of limitations on criminal conduct is 5 years. I think that in many cases it would be very appropriate for the state to wait and make a prosecution decision until after the Legislative Ethics Commission has completed an investigation, and I wouldn't expect that anything in this would preclude that. I would say that the language, in addition to appropriate criminal penalties under another law, was added at our request, because if you don't have that language in, you are precluding criminal penalties that you are excluding legislators from the criminal penalties that are in another law, and I don't think that was anybody's intent. You need to have this language in there. And then to go to Senator Jaroff's point about is prosecution mandatory, the legislature cannot ever, in my opinion, make prosecution mandatory. That's an executive branch function. You don't have the power to direct us in a particular case to prosecute or not prosecute. You can pass a statute making something criminal, and then it's an executive branch function to determine whether or not prosecution will occur.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Jarrell.
Okay, I guess the concern that I have here, and I don't know if this is a parallel or not, but I go back a couple of years to where a fisherman was charged with fishing illegally within the boundaries, within the markers. And the state went after him on a civil charge, and he was innocent. But they turned right around and charged the vessel criminally, and I don't know how they did it. And I guess the concern that I have here, maybe along the same lines Senator Fisher may have mentioned yesterday, you have somebody up in the AG's office there that has a real concern about some legislator or some legislative staffer down here, and then a person is basically charged with something, and they go through the ethics review, and then everything is fine, so there's no civil charge at all, and then all of a sudden somebody, there's this person in the AG's office says, we're going to go after him on a criminal charge. Now, they may not get a conviction on it, but they sure as hell have made it expensive, and they've made that person's life a lot more miserable for a period of time.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jaroff, the problem with that is that the criminal statutes, this is not providing a criminal penalty for violating these statutes. It's just saying that this conduct may subject you to other criminal penalties, and the Legislative Ethics Commission may decide not to act on the complaint because they didn't feel it met the ethics code, or didn't feel it fell within the ethics code. It may, however, violate a criminal statute because the elements are different in the criminal statutes. So they're really two entirely different things.
Mr. Chairman, I know this is probably correct, and it's all in legalese, which is another language I don't understand sometimes, but it just doesn't seem very clear to me, except there that I understand that if you are charged with something, that you do have the civil sanctions that can be imposed upon you. And in addition to that, I'm disregarding subject two. I don't know what subject two means, but I see in addition to those civil sanctions that there are criminal penalties also involved with this. And I don't know how you clarify that or if there is a way to clarify this so that there is a clear understanding by somebody that does not have a law degree.
Maybe a way to say it, Mr. Chairman, would be that a legislator or legislative employee, a person who violates a subsection is subject to civil sanctions under AS 2461-560A and may be subject to prosecution under another law.
That, Mr. Chairman, that would seem to make more sense.
Or maybe subject to criminal prosecution under another law.
Mr. Chairman, I would so move. And quite possibly.
Any objection?
So ordered.
Okay. There are other sections there that
subject
maybe we wish to address that.
Mr. Gagin, Mr. Deardorff, will that be addressed in other sections?
Yeah, we can
do it. And Senator Zaroff, will you make the motion that it should be changed in other sections as well?
So moved.
Any objection?
So ordered, Senator Fisher.
It may be subject to criminal penalties under.
I assume that somebody's getting really don't even require the same.
I think maybe you're referring to legislative employees in this section, not so much to awarding public funds, but to making a false statement in connection with the claim request or application for compensation, reimbursement, or travel allowance for public funds. Maybe that's what that. Because
I
don't know what
to do. For use. I mean, I shouldn't be allowed to accept or use public funds for unlawful purpose. And some of us, okay. Not very many of us, but some of us have the authority to sign and approve claims.
Okay, but I mean, I missed that part. But I don't think the awarding of funds is really what legislative employees do.
No, but we do all these other things.
Right. I agree that you do all those other things.
You award funds.
Okay. Number, Senator Fisher.
Just a general question. There is a code of conduct that's not
a
code of conduct.
Maybe
it would be more comfortable if we just said a one-liner that our employees under the same thing that they do, same standard, period. Then they're out of the bill. Now we're addressing the right to vote. I don't know what that would be. Maybe it's too simple. Why not just say they shall be both now? Whatever is good for the executive branch, good for the public employees. Now they're out of this thing. Then from then on, let's talk about ourselves. Is that too simplistic?
Senator Pershaw.
I think if what we witnessed when we had the joint committee working, we had a lot of employee concerns. We had a lot of staff rereading that executive code, which is fairly thick and has a lot of provisions in it. And I think you'd raise a ton of other questions real fast.
Yeah, I haven't read that either, so I'm not sure I'd want to. I don't want to do that to employees without reading it, I think.
Okay, can we keep going? Let's keep going. Section number B.
Subsection C says that you may not require or permit an employee under your supervision to do personal services or assist in private activities unless, except in unusual and infrequent situations where it's necessary to allow you to perform public duty or official duties.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about this section. I'm not going to talk about school bills right now.
Okay, we'll leave that open. Can I have some paper clips or something? Sorry, Mark, please.
Why don't we break at noon?
Let's try to get off page 11.
Yeah, maybe what we should do, Mr. Chairman, is... Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Maybe what we should do is try to keep our... And I'm good at this, but keep our questions short, make some motions, get some decisions.
And just move. And just keep moving on.
Yeah.
Okay, misuse of state property on still on the bottom of page 11.
That's open. It's open. It's open.
We're going to come back.
We can work on that. It needs to be in there.
Okay. Bottom of page 11, misuse of state property resources for political purposes.
Okay. This subsection A says basically you can't use public resources to influence an election. That includes an initiative election as well as an election of a candidate.
Question, Mr. Chairman? Senator Frank. Okay. How about the circumstance where you take... your files from, all the people that have written to you on the death penalty or whatever, and you take that little computer disk out of your machine and you take it down to your campaign headquarters and put it in your machine down there. Now, would that sort of thing be inappropriate?
That is subject to interpretation. A lot of it's that's the point of the whole discussion we had on this section. Kind of came down to that kind of line. In fact, that example was you. This system of ethics, is a body of law that's subject to interpretation, and that's why you have the advisory opinions. People ask for advisory opinions, and you have some hopefully impartial group making decisions on what those lines are. But on this particular one, that was exactly the point, because at some level above that, it's not, you know, you can't have your employees, you know, typing up your campaign literature and utilizing the distributors' lists on the machines. But at some point, it's like using the telephone for a personal phone call. I mean, nowadays, disk copy, and you wouldn't even take the disk. I mean, what you really do is just copy the disk, make a duplicate, and even buy your own disk and take it down. So, but the information that generated that clearly was done by state employees and state equipment. I don't think there's an answer to that.
She thinks there is.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I think the answer to that, if it's documents and information prepared on state time by state employees on state equipment, that it's a public record and it's subject to the Public Information Act, and it's probably, if somebody wanted to push it, you'd be required to disclose it. It's not. There's not an exception for legislators in the public information law.
That's a topic.
So then it's covered in the exception that's already in here, that it doesn't apply to mailing list computer data or other public information lawfully obtained from a government agency and available to the general public for non-governmental purposes.
She gave you a good answer to your question, but she gave you a reason that you don't want to hear. I mean, the implications of that are...
Sure. Where are we?
So we move on, huh?
Okay.
Page 12.
Subsection B is similar to subsection A. It's also similar to 130, and it's got, again, the use of public funds, time, facilities, equipment, mailing list, computer data, etc. This time for the purposes of political advantage rather than private advantage.
I think this may be different.
Mr. Senator Duncan?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've been looking at whether we should delete time here. This may be different because you are talking about political activities such as fundraising, campaigning, et cetera, and quite honestly, we shouldn't be doing that on public work day.
Senator,
we should be doing that.
Well, the same thing that would apply is in the example that Senator Frank used, though. I mean, if you're in the middle of a campaign and you're at your interim office and your campaign headquarters calls you, you pick up the telephone and talk to them, is that time that's devoted for political purposes as opposed to public purposes?
Good point. Make the motion.
I don't know.
Well, then we get back, I mean, to a very real problem with legislative employees. Maybe if we discuss it enough, we'll arrive at the same conclusions that the previous committee did, that we ought to just, you know, take the language and
cross our fingers.
To a degree.
Commission.
Do you think we should take time out here?
Pardon?
Do you think we should take time out?
I mean, if you want to be consistent with the other section, I mean, the argument applies whether it's business for personal financial gain, or if it's political for political gain.
I guess
the principle is the same. It's a different...
I guess I'm becoming convinced by Senator Binkley.
I don't feel that
strong. But I'm not sure Senator Binkley's convinced, so maybe I'm not convinced.
Let's go ahead.
I mean, there's a real problem, too. And I think that is a real problem.
Can we
be dealt with.
Can't we now, in this case, distinguish between the legislators and legislative employees? I mean... seems to me, if you're in your interim office and somebody calls on the campaign, or you call the campaign office, that's pretty darn normal. But you shouldn't have your staff working on your campaign.
That's right. That's right.
And so let's make a distinction there. Let's take time out for legislators and leave it in for employees.
Staff on campaigns is covered in C.
Oh, I think it is covered in C. I think you're right.
Well, may not be required.
Why don't we say may not permit? Why don't we change in subsection C the require to permit?
No, that's
a little
broad. Yeah, and they can't do it.
Then they can't.
No, it says on government time. On government time. Oh, that is too broad. You're right.
Yeah, that would be like the Hatch, Federal Hatch Act or whatever.
Well, but I'm not sure that any employee on government time can do this stuff, can they?
Well,
can they? They shouldn't. So this refers to on government time. I mean, it doesn't say they can't do it in the evenings,
Well, it says you may not require your staff to help on your campaign.
On government time.
No. No.
On government time.
It says on government time.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. So it's okay to require them to do it in the evenings.
And their personal time.
Yeah, and their personal time. That's covered somewhere else, isn't it?
Well, I guess that's where I suggested, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I suggested changing require to permit, that you will not allow them on government time.
Yeah, we got a whole section of campaigns. It seems like it should be covered.
Unless there's a problem with that. That seems to solve the problem of time in line 5. If we deleted time in line 5, Yeah. And then put it down here, a legislative employee may not permit a legislative employee or allow a legislative employee on government time to assist in political party, et cetera. I guess the attorneys down there are just all diving under the table. We must be doing something wrong.
Lori?
Mr. Chairman, I made a big effort in my review of the bill to get rid of all the permits because I don't think that, you know, parents permit their children to do something. I don't know that an adult really can be responsible for permitting another person to do something. And I've encouraged people to use either the word authorize, so that it says may not require or authorize, or in another place we've used the word aid, induce, cause, or encourage. Because permit, it just doesn't apply in the situation.
Why don't we just be more direct and say a legislator or legislative employee may not, on government time, assist in political party activities, campaigning, fundraising, or other parts in their personal political activities.
That sounds better, actually. Does that make legal sense?
But are you
I don't think it covers...
It leaves off the situation of, you know, it covers the person being prohibited from doing it, but it doesn't address a legislator trying to make somebody do it.
I got another suggestion then. I mean, a legislative employee may not, on government time, assist in political party activities, campaigning, fundraising, or other parts in their personal political activities.
Mm-hmm. One thing.
It doesn't. Does that imply that you should not require or try to induce or whatever? I don't know.
It just says they may not do it.
Yeah.
It covers the legislative employee's conduct, but it doesn't cover the legislator's conduct in attempting to get somebody to do that. And, you know, and I guess that would tie in with the duty to reject improper instructions.
That's right. The employee just tells you to go jump in a lake, right? I mean, they know they can't do it. And the employee says, we can't do that.
Right, so then you're putting all of the burden on the legislative employee, and the legislator is not prohibited from... You can do that. I'm not saying that you can't do that. I'm just telling you what it means to adopt the amendment.
Senator Fisher.
Chairman, I know commentary departments, but I think I'm going to refer to the paragraph that really applies to what we're doing here. It's on page 26, where they're talking about special problems with senior aid. It says, men legislators are assistant volunteer aid officers and campaign advisors. It is unrealistic to expect that such persons will not be involved intimately in the full political life of their employer. As long as the senior aid does a full day's work for a full day's pay to justify the government salary, party and campaign effort above and beyond public duty should be tolerated. And in some cases, a portion of the aid salary will be paid out of campaign funds. But once one begins to use other legislative staff, however, now you have a serious problem. So what we're saying is that senior aid can be involved with political activities while they're in your employee, as long as they get the state a full day's pay, then you can pay them on campaign time.
Yeah, and I think we're trying to talk about government time. Let me make one other suggestion, see if the attorneys don't like this one, okay? And I'm trying to structure something here. Why don't we say a legislator may not require, nor may a legislative employee on government time assist in political party activities, campaigning, fundraising, or other parts of their personal political activities?
Yes.
Would that work?
Senator Frank.
That sounds, you know, if Fisher hadn't brought up the commentary, I'd have probably gone for that. But, I mean, here again, we've got a situation where the commentary says, acknowledges that you've got people that are intimately involved in the campaigns as well. And they're saying, you know, I guess I envision a 12-hour workday, and you give the state eight, and if your campaign gets four, I guess that's...
That's not government time.
Yeah, right. So... Yeah, okay.
Good.
So I guess maybe that
Mr. Chairman,
I would,
the committee. Senator Duncan.
I would move then that we change the wording of that section to read, a legislator may not require, nor may a legislative employee on government time assist in political party activities, campaigning, fundraising, et cetera.
Any objection to that tactical amendment? Oh, yes. Mr. Deardorff.
Could I suggest doing this in two sentences?
Well, however,
the first sentence would read, a legislative employee may not on government time assist in political party activities, etc., period. A legislator may not require a legislative employee to violate this subsection.
You're the attorney.
There's no act in violation of this subsection.
Is there objection to Senator Duncan's motion?
Okay.
So ordered.
Is it clear
Sure.
Is it clear that the circumstance envisioned in the commentary then, where you know the guy may take three or four or five phone calls during the day, during the course of his or her day, that wouldn't be considered state time?
Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my position is, I'm not sure if it's clear or not, but my position is that commentary at this point doesn't exist or shouldn't exist, and we shouldn't even act on it. We should go back and look at that very carefully before we do. So try to structure something here that seems to be clear without commentary, I think. That's...
Well, that's a good point.
The author of that's not even here.
I hear you, but...
And I'm, one, going to oppose adopting the commentary.
Although the commentary seems to give greater comfort to the reality that some of this happens. I mean, it is okay. It should be tolerable.
I mean, it doesn't give greater comfort to me. I think there are a lot of questions in there, but I'm just one member of the committee. My position is I don't think we should, Mr. Chairman, I think we're going to get ourselves tied up a lot if we keep looking at this, relating it back to a commentary which no one has even reviewed, which I think does have problems. And
would you agree with that, Senator Purcell?
This is an old subject, but I mean, I concur, and I think I stated that before the committee, that the joint committee didn't review
the
guidelines, but
ironically,
there are a lot of things in the commentary that help address the vagaries and the problems that are addressed. But I don't think, barring a committee going through 56 mm-hmm. more pages, mm-hmm. you're going to satisfy yourself to that. And it's clearly not absolutely dependent. It's just helpful. It's not dependent on an interpretation or to interpret the statutes, and it's clearly the statutes that are going to govern. Yep.
Okay. That was adopted. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I had one motion that would go along with that, I think, unless everybody objects to it. I think back on line 5, then, we should delete the word time, because we've addressed it in subsection C, line 5 of this page.
Any objection? Make your motion.
I would move that.
Any objection? So ordered. Okay, let's keep going. D.
Okay. Under this bill, you're allowed 2 free newsletters a year, 2 newsletters paid for by the state. In addition to your what you can voucher on your office account. This section says that the Ledge Council shall adopt policies relating to what has to be in the newsletter, and because they're being paid with public funds, they have to include these 3 items that are set forth in 1, 2, 3.
It's ridiculous.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frank.
I think Senator Duncan says it's ridiculous. And I think we ought to move that out of there. We've got substantial increases, I think, in the office account back there. And I think it's crazy for us to sit around here and decide, if my newsletter is appropriate, if yours is appropriate. I mean, it seems unworkable and unnecessary.
So what is your suggestion?
I would suggest we delete it.
Delete D completely.
Senator Frank, are you also suggesting deleting the free newsletter part that's later
yes.
in the back?
Yes.
Okay,
Wait a minute. Just don't rush. Deleting the what?
Free newsletter.
No, that's another part. That's another topic. I think, if I might, Mr. Chairman, the problem with this is, and let me give myself an example. What this says is, policies must address the form and content of these publications and must include a requirement publication include a brief description of the nature of each bill introduced by the legislature's prime sponsor. I have 52 pieces of legislation. No, I don't know if they're all good or not. Most people think they're probably not. I happen to think that they may be okay. But if I have to have a brief description of all 52 bills, it's ridiculous. And then, who's going to identify the significant bills brought on by the legislature's house? For example, nobody believes that the little bill that I put in that talked about golf carts is significant. It's significant to my community, right? Come on, this is... It's not the question of
in the
name
of each contributor to the legislator's campaign.
Senator Purcell.
I'd like to start over just a little bit on the conversation. I think that people didn't pick up the first part of D there. And also, you have to view it in terms of what's in the back of the bill. 2 newsletters paid for at government expense provided each member of the legislature. That's the premise of providing, some support for an office for bona fide communication with constituents. Now, in D, in the beginning of D, we talk about the Ledge Council developing policies for the format and the content of that, so that it's not each legislature deciding this. And what is envisioned here is that you have authorization for a 4-page newsletter. 1 page of that is going to be kind of a standard format developed by Ledge Council, us, for everybody. And that they are the ones that are going to, work out what is significant, what are the bills. And in answer to Senator Duncan's question, if I don't have 52 bills, but if I had 50 bills that I was proud of, I would put as many as I could on this page, but I'd probably use the other three pages to talk about the rest of the bills. I mean, that's what that's your information to your constituents.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman. And I got to leave here for just a second, but I would suggest, I think Senator Pleshaw makes a good suggestion. Maybe we should leave in, the Legislative Council shall adopt policies relating to a legislator's use of public funds for the production of newsletters or similar publications for distribution to the legislator's constituents, period, and delete the rest of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Frank.
I think I go back to my, my original point that I don't think we've got a major problem out there right now. Some people do newsletters. I don't personally do them. Some people do questionnaires. Some people write a lot of letters, individual letters. I don't know that is a problem that we really need to address. I guess, whether or not they should get some public funds to operate their office is, I guess, and we can argue about how much is necessary. Some people engage, in all kinds of communication with their constituencies. They bring excess campaign contributions into the account. They're very, very active in that. Some people are not so active. It's just a matter of personal preference, and I haven't seen it as, as an abuse of public funds. I guess you could say it's an abuse of campaign funds, but you can, you can use your campaign funds for this kind of activity anyway, it seems. I'm just kind of speaking off the top of my head here. So I don't see why we need to get into this area.
How do you use the word significant contributor and significant bills voted on by the House? How is the term significant used there? Is that just up to the commission to adopt a policy or legislative affairs? See, I don't know what that's meant, significant contributor. I mean, that might be someone under APOC. Under APOC regulations, a significant contributor is someone who's listed on your APOC forms. That's over $100. So that means every contributor that's over $100 would have to be listed. Senator Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's some concern about having enough money to do a newsletter. If a guy wants to do a newsletter, that's fine. I think, I like the idea later in the bill where you have an account established. I guess it's 9,000 or something like that. In my case, because I'm a double member Senate district, you got $9,000 sitting there, and you can utilize that. You can't utilize it for other purposes. You can't put it in your back pocket the way you can now. So it seems to me we've covered the notion that we don't have enough for necessary communications with the constituents. But to get into what should be contained in that, well, I think that strikes to the heart of our ability to present our case in our own fashion, tell the people what we think, and that sort of thing. I just think it's unnecessary to put to have this section in at all.
Senator Fisher,
make a motion.
I agree with Senator Frank, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question is, I develop a newsletter. Do I have to go somewhere for approval of my newsletter?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frank?
I'd make a motion that we delete D.
Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to vote against that motion. I think there is a slight difference here. We're talking about newsletters that are paid for by public funds, not newsletters we pay for. And if that motion is defeated, I'm going to make a motion to delete everything except, and I'm going to add a little bit to my previous statement and add the sentence, the policies must address the form and content of these publications, period. I just think there is a difference. When we're talking about doing our own newsletters with our private funds, I think we can do whatever we want to do. But I think if we are using public funds, that maybe there should be some guidelines put together by Legislative Council as to what we include in there. For example, I don't think it's right for public funds to be used for me to send out a newsletter attacking Senator Pleshaw because on the ethics bill.
Here.
That's exactly
okay.
Right.
Newspapers
are doing
Senator Frank, Senator Frank, make your motion.
Okay. What are you saying now, sir? Nothing.
I was suggesting that you amend your motion to take the first down through publications on line 21, period after publications, and delete everything else.
Okay, I'll accept that as a friendly amendment.
Okay, any object? Okay, Senator Fisher.
Let me tell you why I'm objecting. I think there's I guess I'm coming from the premise that we're supposed to try to be somewhat fair.
Yes.
If the state is going to pay for a publication from us going out, that gives us a clear advantage over anybody else running against us. Basis being, they see your name. Some people just run ads with your name on a piece of paper and just pass that stuff around and psychologists will tell you after a period of time. I just don't think the state should be paying for any of us to do this. If they want to be up front and say, here's $5,000 to do it, you check, you get to pay your income tax and everything I think it's campaigning. Whether you say it was campaigning or not, it is, because all of a sudden now they get a nice little letter from the senator. Because the opponent doesn't have access to state funds. And I think that just that premise is a bad thing to start. If you want to do it, give us the money, and we got to take back and know what we got to justify with anything else. But to say that we're going to say, well, this doesn't prove your benefit, it doesn't prove your benefit. The fact that they get an ad from you.
Senator Frank, if we just took the additional money in the accounts as they're outlined later in the bill, as I said, I think it's $9,000 for a double member Senate district, and did not address the free newsletters, I think the increases are quite adequate, you know. But I'm sure others would disagree with that. That we would have a balance that we could live with. In other words, we took out the language about authorizing newsletters, took out the two free newsletters, and if you want to do a newsletter, it'd be just like now. You'd have to do it with the funds that are provided. And, you know, under the system, you know, if you don't use your 9,000, stays in the treasury, it doesn't, you don't have to pay taxes on it. That's, I think, what I would prefer.
Senator Binkley, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with Senator Fisher. You know, I don't see a problem in the way that it's working now. I think it's dangerous to get into the position that the U.S. Congress is in now with franking privileges. I mean, that can really be an area that can get way out of hand as far as using government money for constituent communications and newsletters. And it makes good sense to me, compensate people fairly, give them enough money so that they can afford to send out newsletters to constituents like we do now. You get $4,000, as you said. You can either put it in the bank and pay taxes on it, or you can use it as legitimate office expenses to send out communications to constituents. And it seems to work good. I don't think there's no way you can abuse it.
Yeah,
either you don't want to spend the money on communication with constituents, or you want to use it for some other office expenditures, or you put it in your pocket and you pay taxes on it as part of your compensation.
I think Senator Binkley's got a good point there too, and I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with $4,000. I don't think others may not be, but I am.
Well, there are a lot of things at work here, and we're changing a lot of different things. For example, $4,000 isn't adequate to do a quarter of a newsletter for most people and all the correspondence they have during the year. $4,000. I do two newsletters a year, and it costs me over $5,000 for those newsletters by the time you do the printing, the postage, and everything else. How I do those newsletters under present law, which is allowable, is I will file an intent to run for office, and I will raise money from campaign donations to communicate with my public. And if people want to contribute to me during the year so I can communicate with them through newsletters, I think that's logical and it makes a lot of sense. However, the way we're changing the campaign financing law, we can no longer do that. People will not have that up to their disposal.
That flexibility. They have to pay for it themselves.
And $9,000 or $7,000 isn't going to get you two newsletters and all the other correspondence you have. So I think it is important, if we're going to tighten up on campaign financing, to have the allowance of two newsletters.
Senator Fisher.
Just in case in point, and I may be in
you do the same thing, don't you?
Yes. There was a newsletter that went out statewide by the Speaker of the House. I don't know. I was told that was done with state funds. Went to every registered voter in the state of Alaska. But people would come to me and say, what's going on here? Because they didn't see any disclaimer. The public expected to be a disclaimer. But anyhow, this went out statewide. Did it go? I better ask. Did it go state funds?
No, I think it did.
Okay, it did. Okay, now that's the kind of thing that the general public or somebody's going to run, say, hey, I have a disadvantage here. 60,000 people already know what the man I'm running against looks like. And, you know, and you're questioning whether that, we're talking about perception here, too.
Well.
And the perception of us getting a letter at state expense sent out with our picture on it, whatever you can look good, I guess you put something else out there. It does register as far as the election goes. Otherwise, some people want to be sending out for the campaign.
Senator Zaroff.
Yeah, I use my twin brother's picture. This is like Robert Redford.
That's why you keep getting
right. Nobody knows me when I go back to the district. But Mr. Chairman, another concern that we've got coming up too is that, you know, your postal rates are going to increase considerably. they're going up again this year. And I understand Senator Fisher's concern about having one upsmanship there on the on opponents. But I think the intent of the newsletter is to get information out to the people. And if you have guidelines that control that, and you do have that through legislation, if they adopt the guidelines, you're going to be pretty much limited in what you can put into the newsletter. And I think what it is, and I've offered this suggestion here, I believe, to the people there that talked to us about it, and I thought it was a good idea. You know, at this time there, when we're looking at our office allowance, I get the same amount of money as my House of Representatives member. The only thing is, my district is twice as large as each one of those. And I'm basically expected to do the same amount of correspondence with the same constituency with half the amount of money. And that's where basically all that office allowance is.
Yeah. Well, it's covered in the bill. Right? You know, there's a greater, you get a premium for if you've got a double member district. I forgot.
$2,000, Senator? $2,000.
Yeah, if you look on them.
Where is that?
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like we're hung up on this, and I don't know what to do, except I'm going to oppose any change here, unless we change campaign financing laws so that after I get elected this time, if I do, after that I can file an intent and raise money for newsletters if I want to. I think this eliminates the problem of people being able to raise money in years when they're not running for office, and that's what the intent was. Otherwise, do we have a motion on the floor?
Yes, you have a motion.
Did you make the motion, Senator Frank?
What was the motion? I made a motion.
Delete D, I think, was the motion.
No, that wasn't
it was amended.
The motion was to amend it to end D after publications on line 21.
The first publications.
The first publications.
So it would have a period after publications, and then it would all be deleted up through line 2?
Yes.
Or, I'm sorry, up through 27. Line 27?
Well, no, up through...
From 17 to line 20 would stay in starting at line 20 with the word, the policies must address the form and content of the vote, would be deleted and everything else would be deleted, right?
No. Line 20, it would end at the end of cations, publications, publications,
yes.
On line 21, period.
Okay. Is there objection to that?
So we're...
Okay. Let's keep going, and then we're going to break here for
lunch.
Okay, we're on E.
Okay, subsection E of this section, again, you're still dealing with improper use of state time, resources, et cetera, for political purposes. Subsection E, unless superseded by policies developed by Ledge Council and adopted by the commission. In other words, what follows in 1, 2, and 3 are temporary in nature only until the commission supersedes them with regs. Subsection 1 says a legislator may not use or authorize the use of public funds, property, primarily intended to influence an election, to disseminate materials primarily intended to influence an election. Then there's a proviso that says it does not apply to newsletters that express the views.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duncan,
the public funds, property, the time statement still is in there again. I think we should just eliminate time where time appears.
Any objection to eliminating time where time appears?
So ordered. We have no more time.
We're going to be out of time real short here, so we'll just keep going.
We are out of time.
Senator?
Council will decide that.
A survey is a legitimate informational tool between you and your constituents. That's not an election tool. It may be used as an election tool later on.
Council will decide that.
Okay, so if a person gets a newsletter out and says, I'm for the permanent fund, where do you stand on this, by the way? That's pretty much campaigning, I think.
You're asking your constituents for their views.
You're asking for their views. You're kind of indicating the senator stands for protecting
On line 11, there's an exception. If you can express your opinion on views or issues before the legislature.
Well, you can do that.
And you certainly can ask your constituents for their views. That's not campaigning. That's being a legislator.
Okay. Line 14.
Okay, line 14. Number two is a ban on using public funds for mass mailing 60 days before a primary election.
That's in regard, of course, to the newsletter, isn't it?
Newsletter and
that's fine.
Whatever
I don't have
else
objection
you might
to that.
Do. I think it's mainly the newsletter.
I think it's very clear. Senator Fisher.
I have an amendment. My amendment would be to put it on the table to change 60 to 90.
No, wait a minute. August.
Does it backs up to
July, June?
Can you give a recap of what's been said?
Well, you're in legislative session, are you not?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pichot.
We had this discussion, and it was actually a longer period of time, but we sat down and figured what the longest 120-day session would run, knowing that the time for newsletter is after the session ends. Mm-hmm. But then you need some time to put it together. 60 days was the latest and the earliest that it seemed like that all could happen, that you have the end of the session, you have 2 or 3 weeks to put together and print a newsletter, and then there's a proper space before the primary. Because that clearly is the time when a legitimate
That's what
newsletter
I said right now.
It's fine.
Try to get out, buddy.
Mm-hmm. Any objections?
Any objections or what?
Did you make a motion?
No, I mean, I said, so at least I can feel it. So I will keep 90 days.
Senator Frank.
I would move that we amend the motion to 75.
Oh. Okay. Object.
I object.
Question.
I object.
Those in favor of the motion, raise their hand. Motion fails. Main motion is for us is 90 days. Those in favor, raise their hands.
Put your hand up. You made the motion.
Both motions failed, so the language stays as it is. Unless there's any other motions. Okay, go to three.
Okay, three says you can't solicit, accept, or authorize the solicitation or acceptance of campaign contributions in a public office. It applies to telephone conversations, personal meetings, solicitations by mail. If an unsolicited contribution is offered in person, it shall be returned. If it's received in the mail, it can be kept, but it has to be transferred out immediately to your campaign headquarters to be processed.
Senator Binkley.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm misreading something. If an unsolicited contribution is offered, it shall be refused or returned promptly?
That's in person. Somebody says, hey, here's $100 for your campaign. Say, hey, take it to my campaign headquarters.
I see.
I can't.
Oh, this is just in the facility.
Right.
In your office.
Sure, you go outside.
But telephone conversations?
Step outside.
Step outside.
You can't sit in your office and
dial for dollars. Right. You can't dial for dollars from your state office.
That's pretty clear, I think. Section is it three? Any questions? Senator Binkley?
Yeah, well, I'm just curious as to what the, you know, does it really make a difference which telephone you're using or where the location of the telephone is that you're calling from?
Who pays for it, mainly, I think.
Well, if it's a local call.
If it's in a facility or office ordinarily used to conduct state government
Obviously,
business.
You can do it from home.
Either from your home.
You can use your home phone.
But you couldn't do it from your capital office.
They can go
office.
To a payphone.
But you couldn't call
Lauren?
Somebody else in the same
You can
town.
Go to a payphone.
Yeah. If you have an interim office as you,
in the Capitol building?
As your interim office as a senator, you could
not inside the Capitol building. That would be a violation.
We all need a payphone in our office.
That's a good point. There is a phone facility downstairs on the floor. I would read this that would be a violation of the law if you went to the and that'd be fine. But I guess you just if the public. Phone is in the building.
Is it in a public hallway?
Remember,
that's not a place normally used for the conduct of state business.
And these can be superseded by regs.
A lot of
regs
conduct a lot of business in halls.
So you're telling you can argue either way. Okay, let's keep going.
Silly.
Senator Fisher.
No, it's personal. Personal.
The 4,000, as I understand it, is being eliminated, and it's being replaced with you can voucher up to 6,000, 7,000, or 9,000. There's no more money that you can put in your pocket if you don't want to spend it. You can charge, you can only use it on legitimate expenses. You don't pay it, in other words.
Well,
you incur the expenses, and then you send the vouchers to LAA, and LAA pays it. And that's to replace the current office allowances.
Okay.
That's different.
So then,
different topic.
I guess my concern with the 4,000 is public funds, if they are public funds, then that's the case.
Yeah, for 4,000 is about 4,000.
And then you get pre-approval for a mailing to somebody, so you can send 5,000 copies out of that account somewhere. Or you go and do it, and then they question it later, then you got to pay for it.
I think that's the way it's supposed to work. The latter.
Senator Brashaw.
Well, once again, the framework here is the they or we. I mean, it's we through the Legislative Council are going to set these guidelines of how this works.
Yes.
No different than they do now for travel policies. And, you know, it's just not you making the decision. It's a group decision on a standardization of the regulations on the permissible use.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to mark this and maybe come back to it if we make another change. I, for one, don't know why, you know, let me be directly here, but I don't know why a clerk in Legislative Affairs Agency should determine whether I can spend my money or not, even though Legislative Council may be involved in it. Quite honestly, I don't know of anyone who's pocketing $4,000 and getting rich. The implication was you just can't pocket that money. Well, you don't just pocket it. You may not have to vouch for it, but you spend probably $12,000 or $15,000 on
expenses. Well, you can. I mean, if you want to, you have the legal right now.
And you won't be in office very long. That means you aren't sending letters out, or you aren't communicating, or you're not doing anything, right? You're just getting rich off of $4,000.
Different topic. Different topic. Keep going.
State government. And we're getting back to the, do we have to have prior approval before we send out a mass mail? And if they look at it, check the content, and you get it cleared to paper, and they just go do it, spend their $2,000, and then ask for reimbursement, they say, well, wait a minute.
Okay.
We don't agree with what you sent out.
The way the bill has been amended, yes, there is approval. It depends on what Legislative Council sets up as procedures, okay? And they can do that, and that's okay.
We may change that anyway. I don't like the voucher system.
Senator, Senator Frank.
Vouchers for public education.
Mr. Chairman,
are we going to request the money?
The Leg Council is going to develop that policy. So whether it's prior approval or not, that's a later date. Decide that at a later date. I don't think I want to have a situation where the Leg Council decides, and approves every letter. I hope and I expect that Leg Council will not adopt a policy of that nature. That would be bad. I don't think they'll do that.
Okay, we're on number three. Anything on three?
Joseph's not in charge of that.
Page 14, four.
Four is gone. Four got moved into comments, the non-existent commentary.
So what do we do? We delete it here.
We deleted it.
Yeah, four is out.
Okay.
We don't like.
Okay, and this one has a penalty section that's a little bit complex. If you violate E1, you can be guilty of theft and can be prosecuted for theft. And as I said, that could be
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
This section's out.
Section F?
Section 4 is out.
Four.
Oh, Section 4, yes. That was moved to the commentary.
Okay, just subsection 4 of...
Yeah, now we're in F.
3.
No,
this 4.
Okay, but I'm...
F, what were we in here?
F is the... I think, John, you were going through F, weren't you?
Okay. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay, now Lori Otto is here for the criminal questions, and that's why. I know she's got other things to do, so I was... How long will it take us to get through the criminal sections here? Is it going
to
be...
Well, we got other things to do, too.
Some of them have criminal and some of them don't. It's going to basically take as long as it takes you to go through the whole thing.
Okay, do people want to break about now and then come back?
Yeah.
I think we're getting tired. Ask members to sort of go through so we have questions ahead of time for the next 20 pages. So when we come back, we can go right through it.
When are we going to do that?
I'm going to give everybody 30 minutes.
And you have lunch in that time?
Yeah,
3 minutes for lunch.
Let's get started. We do have a quorum of the Finance Committee. We are on page 15.
15, okay.
Let's keep rolling. Mr. Deardorff, Mr. Gagin, where are we now?
Well, I had us on 14 still.
Okay. We're on the criminal penalties?
Yeah, just briefly on the penalties for 140, which is improper use of state resources for political purposes. If you violate E1, which is using state resources, monies, etc., you can be prosecuted for theft. Again, it varies up to a C felony, depending on how much is at issue. If you violate E2 or 3 or subsection C, you can be prosecuted for a Class A misdemeanor. And if you violate B, C, or E, you can be subject to sanctions. This was one of those that the Joint Committee looked at and decided, well, this one should be criminal and this one should just be civil. Okay, 150 says a legislative employee who knows that he or she has been asked to do something in violation of
Senator
the
Zara.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, wasn't there a question last night under F, we're under F and G there. Well, wasn't there some confusion as to what supersedes all of this? I thought there was confusion that was expressed by Ms. Burke on that. Can you clarify that so that we fully understand it?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
E1, 2, and 3 are in effect unless the Ethics Ethics Commission, with the guidance, I think, of LEC, issues regulations that supersedes these, goes into them in more detail. But until that happens, these three are the applicable section.
Okay.
Okay, 150, A.
Wait a minute, I still have a question on line 18, that where it says subject to. Now, is this going to be reflected there in an amendment that we made earlier? Wasn't that a question there that I had back on page 11? Or, no, I'm sorry, the question I had before was in addition to. I guess, okay, that's fine.
Yeah,
all right.
Okay, 150, a legislative employee who knows that he or she has been asked to do something in violation of this chapter shall refuse to do it. And subsection V, if the person's boss persists or if reprisals are threatened, then the person being threatened shall report the matter to the commission.
14, thank you.
This is subject only to civil sanctions.
Questions on page 14.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Zaroff.
How does that work there? Is there anything in writing at all at this point? Because I can see where it may be that a person may be asked to do something and then they don't want to do it, and then the boss says, okay, well, you're fired. Yeah. Then what does the individual do then? Who do they go to? And when they make their complaint, is it a written complaint so that it's there in its entirety at that time? And does the person have, whether it's, I would assume it must be the legislature then, do they have a recourse to respond to that, or how does that work?
Well, this section only addresses the obligation of the employee. It doesn't address the employer. I assume at the moment if you believe that you're improperly, if you've been asked to violate a subsection, you could file a complaint under whatever section you've been asked to violate, and you could bring an action, a wrongful discharge action.
Chairman, is there a grievance procedure in place now for any grievance at all that a person may have?
Answer's no. Okay, let's keep going.
Okay, 160 says that Ledge Council should develop regulations on essentially 130 and 140 and recommend them for adoption by the council. And by the commission, subsection B says if the Ledge Council doesn't do that, then the commission shall do it on its own.
Okay. That's fair.
I'm real concerned with that one because the Legislative Council shall annually review the regulations and recommend changes. Well, supposing they don't do that, don't make any changes, but the commission feels there should be some changes made, they just can go ahead and do it regardless of what the Legislative Council does.
That's true. They're the ones that issue the regulation.
So, if they disagree when the change is being made, they can still disagree with what they want to do. So I thought the Legislative Council really had some clout.
Well, I guess it depends how you define clout. If Legislative Council was chosen to do this because they are the people that know the legislative process, and I think you have to assume some good faith on the part of the commission that if Ledge Council comes to them with regulations that are reasonable, the commission isn't going to ignore them.
But the ultimate power, so to speak, is with the commission.
True.
Any more questions on 160? Line 14, use of non-public information for private gain.
Okay, this is non-public information is defined back in the definition section at page 83 as information which, although it's technically public under the public records law, is the sort of information that wouldn't come to the general attention either of the public or to, let's say, if a legislator was a lawyer, wouldn't come to the general attention of the Bar Association. This provision says that you may not use, it's akin to insider information. You can't use insider information for public gain.
Any questions?
For private gain.
Senator Fisher.
What's the difference between insider information for POMs that we get? The general public doesn't get public opinion, that's legal. So isn't that insider information to take that information and use it for political purposes or something else? That's not general
This is just private purposes.
No, this is pecuniary benefit. It's a benefit, which is it's got to be a pecuniary benefit. Benefit is defined.
This is supposed to address the situation, say, where you're looking at, you happen to see some memo, DOT memo, which is technically subject to public inspection, but nobody really knows it's out there, and it says, we're going to be extending the Minnesota Freeway. So you go out and buy up all the land around the Minnesota Freeway because you know it's going to go up in value tremendously. That's basically what it's supposed to address.
We're in your favorite section.
We are?
Yes. Hi, Lori.
Hello, sir.
Thanks for coming down.
Just started.
Coming up.
Not public information.
Senator Duncan.
Just one question so I understand it. Who makes the I know non-public information is defined.
Has anybody said that?
But how do you determine what is not readily accessible and what might be the type of information that would cause a problem?
Lori has lots of problems with this section, and let her speak, address them. They're all valid concerns, I think, too.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes.
Senator Duncan, I've expressed my concern on this non-public information section repeatedly. The way that I read the definition that's on page 83, it seems to me that it applies to information that's said on the record during a public hearing. And, you know, if there is a reporter present who writes about it, it's probably not non-public information. If there's not a reporter there, or if there's a reporter there who doesn't write about it, it probably would be non-public information. Beyond that, it seems to me that it could apply to things like personalities. I work with the legislature a lot. I'm aware of different personality clashes. I'm aware of, you know, certain things to avoid or to do when I'm trying to get legislation through, and that technically would be non-public information. And what I have said to the Legislative Ethics Committee is we have an incredibly broad public records law, that it makes most things public information, and to impose sanctions, and the criminal sanctions have been taken out, but the section still affects the Department of Law, because it seems to me, and this goes back to one of the other concerns that Susan Burke had, I don't know that I think that the Legislative Ethics Commission has any kind of legal authority over former legislators or former legislative employees, which would then mean that the Attorney General's office would be in the position of enforcing the civil sanctions, and then we come back to the problem of what's non-public
yes.
information. I think the term is vague.
Yes.
I don't think it means anything, right. And I've always had a problem with it.
Okay. Question, Senator Duncan.
No, go ahead, Steve.
Well, what's your suggestion then on how we address this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frank, my suggestion is either come up with a definition that makes sense, and that somebody who is subject
to
the law,
sense.
You know, that somebody knows what's public information and not public information, or else delete the section.
Okay.
Because if you can't agree right now what's non-public information, how is the person who works for the legislature
exactly.
supposed to know later on?
Exactly. Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I haven't had any reaction from anybody else, but I think that does make sense. And I would move and see what people say here that we delete sections 2461170.
Okay, but we also have to delete the definition of on page 83.
Unless it's used elsewhere.
It's used elsewhere.
It is used elsewhere.
Yes.
Okay, we'll find.
But we'll have to take care of those problems as we go, I guess.
It's used in the same way in other places.
If you don't, all right, Mr. Chair. Is a policy judgment, if you don't like the term, I think it's safe if you do away with the concept of non-public information everywhere. I think it all relates to the same
okay.
use of the term non-public.
Okay. Is there objection to Senator Duncan's motion to delete all that? And make the corresponding change. Any objection? So ordered. Are there other sections we should be aware of that... Where else is it covered in the bill, Lori?
Well, there's other places that talk about what a form of post service restrictions. It talks about using non-public information, as
gotcha.
I recall. There are a couple other places, but as Senator Porchot said, it's used in the same way all the way through the bill. So the motion could say take it out every place that it's used, and I think that you would solve the problem.
Okay. Misuse of title or prestige of office.
Okay. This is several sections. Subsection A, a legislator employee may not use the title, official letterhead, or prestige for the benefit of the legislator. B, you may not solicit or accept anything of value under terms where you appear to be getting paid a large amount extra because you're a member of the legislature.
I have that in parentheses. Did we move that to the front,
or
am I mistaken? Or we just came to my attention. Page 16, top of the paragraph. Did we move that? I have it circled. Did we move that to the front or something?
No, but I think it was, Mr. Chairman, at the top of the next page?
Yeah.
I think it was something that Susan Burke pointed out being a reasonable person would interpret. But let me ask a question, and I'm going to ask one quick question to talk to this. I got to tell you, I think legislators use letterhead for personal advantage in a number of ways. I use it to impress people that I'm in the legislature. And that gives me a personal advantage over somebody who's not in the legislature. I mean, that's part of incumbency. Is that going to be prohibited under this? It doesn't say for economic gain, it says for personal advantage. And
that's for benefit.
That's the operative word. And we define that elsewhere as pecuniary gain?
Basically.
We define it as what?
Benefit, anything of value, benefit, or thing of value are all defined in the same definition, and it's a laundry list of basically pecuniary advantages.
So monetary, pecuniary.
It's a...
Page 79.
Page 79.
Okay.
Why
don't
we just say monetary benefit? Maybe not.
Okay. Definitions are on page 79?
Yes, and the definition of benefit is on page 79, starting at line 21. Actually, starting at line 15.
But to have a campaign advantage is not prohibited here, then. To have the advantage of the incumbent as being in the legislature, you don't think this prohibits us?
It does not include campaign contributions, pledges, political endorsements, support in a local campaign, or a promise of endorsement or support.
Senator Pershaw, okay.
Yeah. Maybe so many times on these sections, I think it's helpful to go all the way to the end of the section because, for example, on page 16, line 11, E section and E section are kind of modifiers of A, B, and C. That structure, by the way, Mr. Chairman, is true in a lot of sections. And that kind of represents, I think, a lot of the work of the Joint Committee, where we had a lot of the same initial reaction concerns and then tried to further limit or define the terms later in the section.
Okay, bottom of page 16.
Mr. Chairman, on 16, one of the concerns I had is as far as using a letterhead, say, for giving somebody a letter of preference, that's okay. In other words, you have to use a letterhead. The other, when you talk about title and prestige, when you fill out an application for employment, and they ask your title, and you put down the senator, and the way you influence the job, they see what you're doing. That's okay to do also.
I think so.
I guess I'm one of those that say, gee, black or white, and I just, I think so.
Well, okay. Senator Fisher, and you're familiar with our advisory opinion process. You get yourself in real trouble when you give a hypothetical and more details aren't known. I'm not a lawyer, but I learned long ago, like 2 or 3 years ago, don't give off the cuff advice when you see the thing and it looks a lot different from as it was described to you. So that was the only hesitation. Because as you pointed out last night, there has been an advisory opinion on this issue, and there are limits to that. Because at some point, you might be using your title for financial gain.
So the best thing would be to do is, you know, apply for a job and get it okay first. I'm talking about the regular application. You say, can I use this up? I'm talking about the form developed by IBM, and it says occupation. I better check and make sure that's not a violation going off the hook. So somebody later says, he got a job that I qualified for, well, he's a legislator, he got it. And right or wrong, the perception is going to be yes. So if I get it cleared, not me, anything. If we get it cleared with the commission, then we're okay. If they say, yes, go ahead. And we say, wait a minute, I'll clear it back in 1999. That's what we're saying.
But even a larger question, Mr. Chairman, is that just as the Ethics Committee has operated, once this LEC starts operating, they're not going to answer a lot of these questions individually. They'll just pull out the file and say, it's perfectly acceptable to use your title on an application for employment, and then that'll be widely distributed. And a lot of these kind of baseline questions will get resolved fairly early in the game and won't have to go through individual process.
Any other questions on that? Senator Zara.
Thank you, Chairman. How do you fill out a resume, then, if you're, once you've been in the legislature, and you work for, from 1979 to 1989 as a representative or as a senator or as a legislative aide? How do you fill out the resume to indicate that you've worked? Do you just say that you work state government?
That's not using your title. That's answering your question about what you did for a living. That's not using your title or abusing your title. I don't think anybody in the world with a reasonable mind would find a person doing something wrong if they said, from X time to Y time, I was a state representative or a state senator or a legislative employee of some sort. That's just answering questions.
Okay.
And if you put it in guilt and neon lights and said, and therefore you should hire me, that's another story.
Mr. Chairman, then, you know, I still had this question I wanted to ask back at the beginning on Section A. A lot of us have business cards. And on the business card, you've got the state seal. Now, does this prohibit you from handing out your business card? And I guess when I look at the definition back here of anything of value, benefit, or a thing of value, you know, use of automobiles, car rental agencies, for example, if you're on state business or wherever, or hotels, you have government rates, non-government rates. How does that affect there? If you have a business trip there that you're on, and your constituent there is also on a similar trip, but he is or she is not associated with state government at all, and they have to pay a full rate, and then because you put out your business card or you put your legislative ID on there, and you get the government rate. Are you using that then to as a benefit for yourself?
No. That's the status. You're part of a class of people called government employees who are entitled to a benefit that every other government employee is entitled to. It's not because you are a senator that you're
getting. But I think there is, generally, you're not supposed to do that. I mean, you're not supposed to get a discount at a hotel because you're a government employee when you're not on government business.
Well, that's correct. Right. Yeah. I assumed he was talking about times when it's legitimate to do so.
Right.
Okay, I just want to make that clear.
Okay. I don't travel that much, but
yeah. We're probably overreacting here anyway because.
Any other questions on that? We'll go down to line 24 on post service restrictions.
Okay, post service restrictions, there's different restrictions for legislators and for legislative aides. A legislator may not lobby, and again, this is for money, for a period of 1 year after leaving office, lobby the legislature or lobby a state agency if the matter is one over which you had special oversight or budget authority. And that's defined as being limited to a handful of people, the president or the Senate speaker in the House, the chair of the Finance Committee of either House, or chair of a committee directly connected on a regular basis with the agency's activities. A legislative assistant, and again, the assistant is not all employees, it's the senior employees, are restricted only from lobbying the legislature for pay for a period of 1 year after they leave.
Okay, run that by us again.
Okay, the legislator and the senior aides may not lobby the legislature for money for a period of a year after leaving office or employment. In addition, if a legislator held a key committee, was a presiding officer, finance, or a committee chair, he or she could not lobby an agency over which there was special oversight responsibility.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. in detail, but when you say with special oversight or chair or a committee, you know, many times the way it works here is the operating budget is broken down into all the operating categories, operating agencies. Each member of finance is a chairman of that subcommittee over that aspect of government. One has revenue, one has university, one has CNRA, one has DMVA, one right on down the line, education. They probably individually have more control over what that actual budget is than the chairman of the committee itself. I mean, they have pretty broad authority in that budget category. Would this apply to anybody who chaired that individual?
No. The joint committee specifically
just
considered putting in finance sub-chairs and did not do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would disagree with that. I think that the chairman of the subcommittees have more influence over what that individual budget is than the chairman of the finance committee. And I don't know what an appropriate...
I think it should be apply across the board for everybody as well.
That's right. This restriction
applies
to everyone.
Ridiculous.
Chairman.
Senator Petrullo.
been my long experience that the chairman of the subcommittees have more to say about the department than the chairman of the standing committees do. All too often, that's the case, because this will be, again, the area of final decision, both for bills that affect the department and this. They're very important. I would rather be the chairman of the subcommittee on finance than any but one or two other committees of the state legislature. That's a fact.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, let me be sure I understand this. And we're doing two things here. One is a legislator or a legislative employee may not lobby the legislature, the administration, or the administration. May not. Well, what the heck are we doing here? they can't lobby the legislature for 1 year, but they could lobby the administration.
Right.
An assistant can lobby the administration
if they weren't directly involved. Even a legislator could lobby the administration if they weren't directly involved.
Right.
You know,
so it's only the chairman of finance and the speaker.
Senator Frank.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think it's
the perk of being finance chairman.
Mr. Chairman, on this, it seems like we either have everyone that's in the legislature barred for 1 year, which is, I guess, I thought what the bill had, but, you know, just hearing people talk in the halls, or we ought to have no prohibition, because it seems to me to be, you know, I mean, if somebody wants to, you know, make deals to do things in the budget process or to trade votes to provide, gains to people and stuff like that. Well, you know, you don't have to be in any particular position to do those kinds of things. And so it seems like everyone ought to be barred.
Is there any objection?
Not just focus on people who ostensibly might appear to be leadership people.
Senator Frank, we make a motion, please.
Yeah, I would move that we just make a bar on all legislators for 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Any objection to that?
Wait a minute.
Well, Senator Zaroff has an objection.
I just wouldn't find out what that does.
Applies across the board to everyone. Okay. Senator, well, there is an objection. Senator Duncan.
I don't understand, too. So that would mean that legislators for 1 year couldn't lobby the legislature or the executive branch, which, okay. How about legislative employee? Did you include them in there?
It was just a motion.
Well, I want to understand, because this also talks about employees.
Yeah, I don't think that legislative employees should be barred, frankly. It's my.
They're in two separate sections. Now, A applies to legislators and has the administrative ban. B applies to TAs.
Oh, I'm sorry, it does. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm with your motion there.
Excuse me?
Here, I'm fine.
Okay.
There was no objection to the
section. So, Mr. Chairman, let me understand. So, Section A just refers just to legislators.
Right.
And then they're banned for 1 year for lobbying either the administration or the legislature.
And it's the same for legislative assistants, is that right?
No, not yet.
We would scratch B.
Okay. Is there any objection to Senator Frank's first motion?
No, I support him. Let me see if I understand, though. Former employee, who sanctions the act? Is it the commission then if you go after the former employee? Let's say that if one of us leaves the legislature 6 months later down here lobbying. Does it come under this law? Does it come under?
I don't know.
Who has the power to say?
That's a questionable one, isn't it?
Yeah, when you're not a legislator.
Yeah.
You're not a legislator. Yeah, Senator Pershaw.
Well, I mean, as you've heard from all the attorneys, there is a real question on whether any legislative body can reach out and discipline a former legislator. But in the case of lobbying, if this were in, we referenced, I believe, the lobbying statutes to the APOC. And so conceivably,
this one, it's a Class A misdemeanor.
How much is
it? Can be prosecuted criminally, and it can be brought by the state by the Attorney General as a civil action.
What's a Class A misdemeanor, Carrie?
It's a year in jail and a $5,000 fine.
Oh.
The problem.
I'll take $5,000 and continue to lobby.
Up to a $5,000 fine. There's another problem, though, is that if you look at Section D that starts on page 17, line 17, it gives the Legislative Ethics Commission the power to grant waivers to former legislators and legislative assistants. And again, as Senator Porcho just said, there's a pretty significant legal question on whether or not the legislature has the ability at all to regulate the conduct of former legislators and legislative employees. That would be something that should be left to either the executive or the judicial branch. And so I don't quite understand how you would get into the issue of waivers. I think that's a question that needs to be looked at. Mr. Deardorff suggests doing it over the interim.
Senator Pierce and then Senator Pershaw.
I have a question about how the sections work. When we say in line 27, page 16, legislators may not act as a lobbyist in seeking to influence, are we talking primarily about going to work as a paid lobbyist as opposed to if I own a business and the legislature takes up an issue that is of grave concern to my business? You're not saying I can't come down here and say, here's what you're doing to me. I do or I don't want you to do it. You're talking about pain.
As we discussed, Mr. Chairman, as we discussed last night, lobbyist, when it's used here, is a defined term. It does include the current APOC statutory definition of paid lobbyist, does not include volunteer lobbyist or representation lobbyist. And that applies in this case. This question of former legislators or former legislative assistants, this, by the way, this was not only discussed in the Joint Committee, this has been discussed in the Ethics Committee the last 2 years on some real cases. And it is not a clear question, and the Joint Committee was fully aware that at some point in time there may be a constitutional issue or case developed where the courts will say, no, the legislature does not have this authority. The Joint Committee felt that there was, forgetting the sanctions, that there was still instructional value in having the legislature